Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So Catherine Whittaker and myself, David Law, join you from where the boat leaves on its way to the O2 Arena for the ATP Finals. This is where the players board, just outside Waterloo Station. We're next to the River Thames. We're not actually in Waterloo Station today, so you won't hear any of our travel reports, but what you will hear about is lots of tennis, because there's been lots of it going on. Catherine Whittaker, how are you today?
Very well, thank you. I've just done a commute, which is an alien concept for me.
Yeah.
Did
it follow a nap?
No, I wish it had done. Too early for one of those. Commuting. I mean, probably, I shan't slag it off too much, because probably lots of people listening to this are, as I speak, commuting. Yeah. I feel for you, yeah, is what I have to say.
Indeed.
I feel your pain.
Yeah.
Well,
so basically, what is it? Over 2 weeks from now, it'll be time for the ATP Finals, and in London, we've just had the WTA Finals. It's final year in Singapore. That's the first thing we're going to be talking about today. We're also going to be talking about another title for Roger Federer.
You'll be saying final a lot. The WTA Finals final for the final time in Singapore.
Yeah. Okay, I've overdone finals, everybody, and we're...
Well, no, there's no way to avoid it.
I know. The decider. The clincher.
I did the voiceover yesterday evening for the highlights programme of the WTA Finals final. I didn't write the script, but, you know, we were having to use championship match.
Oh, right, okay.
Which is the most American turn of phrase that's ever come out of my mouth. But it's the only way to avoid just saying finals, final, finals.
Anybody got
finals,
anything final else? At Tennis Podcast, we're going to be talking about the Basel clincher, which Roger Federer won. Vienna, won by Kevin Anderson. We're seeing pictures on a TV adjacent to us at the moment of Greg Rusedski holding aloft the Paris Indoor Trophy, and Sebastian Grosjean as well.
That's Tim Henman.
Yeah, that's Tim Henman. And it's that lovely tree, isn't it? The old...
it's Thomas Burdick.
Yeah, he winning the title when he was wearing his cap indoors. But yeah, the Paris tournament about to take place this week. We're going to be talking about Great Britain doubles success. We've got
Robin Söderling.
All right.
Forgot that he won it.
Stefanos Tsitsipas.
David Ferrer won it. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
2012, apparently.
So you are lots of...
It's had some interesting winners. I forgot that Songa won it as well. Robin Söderling.
Jack Sock is currently being shown holding the trophy. And I'll tell you
feels
what,
like a long time
let's
ago.
Skip forward very much in the old agenda to the fact that if Jack Sock doesn't win his first round match in Paris this week, he goes down to 140 in the world. Crikey.
Which is probably a fair reflection of his year, face it.
In singles, it is.
It is a fair reflection of his year. The rankings don't lie.
I'm not sure.
They have been lying for a long time.
He's not even won 10 singles matches this year. But in doubles, he's won 2 Grand Slams and has been the best doubles player in the world. It's funny how that works, isn't it? Why can you be so effective in doubles and not singles?
Well, I would just insert a couple of caveats there. Yes, he is one of the best doubles players in the world, but he's also, well, until potentially next week when he tumbles outside the world's top 100, he's the top ranked player by a mile that consistently plays doubles. You don't know, I mean, get all of the top 30 players playing doubles and he probably wouldn't be the best doubles
players
in the world.
He is really good at doubles.
He is, but so could a lot of them be if they committed to doubles.
Wouldn't it be great if they all
but
did?
It is a curiosity because my understanding was that his very successful partnership with Vasek Pospisil, they of course were Wimbledon champions, my understanding is that that disintegrated because Jack Sock didn't want to be a doubles player.
Well,
he wanted to be a singles player.
But who does? You know, it's so rare.
Well, Jack Sock now, apparently.
Well, yeah, and I'm pleased that he does, and I think he should do more of it. And I still would love to see a combined singles and doubles ranking where everybody has to play doubles. Anyway, that's not going to happen.
That would be. I suspect Jack Sock might start campaigning for that.
Yeah.
Quite fervently.
I wonder where he'd be. He'd be like 10 in the world, wouldn't he?
Split the difference.
It's a combined.
No, he wouldn't.
At the moment.
What, 104? Oh, at the moment, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, things could change in 7 days.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about tennis jokes, if we can get it in, because we keep banging on about how we're going to do it. I had my latest tennis joke this week. This time I was 5-4 up in the first set tiebreak. Mini break to me. 2 serves to win the set for the first time ever against Solly Hall-Simon.
And I
failed again. I failed again. So, yeah, I'm a perfect person to talk about
that
chokes.
Trusty serve, David, letting you down.
It was untrustworthy today. Right, Elina Svitolina is the champion in Singapore. The final time it's been held in Singapore before it goes to Shenzhen in China for a 10-year stay. My goodness, a lot of money going on there. Svitolina, if you lined up the 8 players as they do, I would have thought she would have been the least talked about at the start of the tournament and the least likely to win. That is what I would have said at the start of the tournament.
Well, before having seen the speed of the court?
Yes, even... I mean, I take your point that it's more gives. It obviously helped her. And actually, you said last week that the tournament was there for Sloane Stephens to win. She got to the final undefeated. I think that was very much borne out the way it went. It suited her down to the ground. She was brilliant. I'm still quite surprised that she didn't win the final yesterday. What was your take on the final? I saw some of it, but not all of it.
I was surprised as well. I think when she was 2 love down, and Svitolina was serving, and she had a whole raft of break points to break her back and get back on serve in the deciding set. And it felt like the difference between 2-1 and 3 love was everything. And at that point, I still was picking Sloane Stephens to win it. She didn't break, and I thought, okay, that you know, this is probably over now. And then she did rally, she did hold, and then break back. And I thought, oh, okay, well, my prediction's back on. You know, I still back Stephens for this with the greater big match experience, but I underestimated Svitolina. He was so gritty, so gritty in that final. And Stephens ran out of gas, which is perhaps understandable. You know, the matches were punishing in Singapore because of the speed of the court. You know, it was so hard to win points, so hard that, yeah, it was a punishing week, a punishing year for Sloane Stephens. You know, last year she didn't play a full year of tennis, so probably has taken a toll on her body, but it was still a bit alarming. Not alarming, I mean, I don't think there's any reason for alarm, but just in the moment it was jarring to see Sloane Stephens, who I think of as sort of the supreme athlete, really, just running out of steam. Svitolina was comfortable with making it a physical battle. She knew she had the gas in the tank, which I don't think would have been the case a few months ago.
She definitely looks in a better place.
She looks in a better place. She spoke quite frankly at the start of the tournament. She didn't necessarily talk explicitly about her struggles with her weight, although it seems pretty obvious to me that there have been considerable struggles over the years. She talked about the abuse that she's received on social media as a result
horrible.
Of it, and how much it's affected her, and obviously goes without saying that that's all completely ghastly. And you know, I'm very, very reluctant to comment on players' physiques in terms of slenderness, because different folks, different strokes, different things work for different people. But she was completely, you know, looking at her US Open US Open, you know, under a microscope. She was obviously completely underpowered, and she was running out of gas and you know, just wasn't working. And she actually said after that, didn't she, to a Ukrainian, there was something translated from Ukrainian where she said, she as much as said, look, I know I've gone a bit too far. I need to try and find a middle ground here. I'm on a learning curve here with my body, yeah, and adjusting my game to my body. And I don't know if she's there. I think just making assessments just purely on the basis of how she looks to our naked, untrained eye is probably a bit dangerous. But she's obviously getting to somewhere.
She looked full of energy, didn't she?
Yeah, there was no doubting the gas she had in the tank.
No, and I mean the people
she seemed to have
beat.
A little bit more power.
Yeah,
a little bit more power behind the shots.
There was enough there, and the thing is with Svitolina, she's not a ball striker like Pliskova or Kvitova. She's a package of good ball striking from both sides, forehand and backhand. She can hurt you from both, particularly the backhand, but she's an incredible mover. She can chase down balls and stay in rallies, and also is just generally a great athlete. She looks like a jock, you know, in that way, as though she could be good at all sorts of sports. I think if you put her on the track, she could be an excellent track and field athlete. And the people she beat along the way, beat Wozniacki, Kvitova, Pliskova, Bertens, and then Stevens to go undefeated in the WTA finals.
Yeah, and there's lots of different styles of opponents as well, crucially. First undefeated champion at the WTA finals since Serena Williams in 2013.
Wow.
So more often than not, the champion does, you know, usually lose a match,
and she's had
match
a
or two at the group stage.
Not only the conversation that we've just been having, but her results have been nothing like they were for the last 6 months. The first 4 or 5 months of the year, she was doing well. Apart from the slams, it had gone in the way that it had the last couple of years. Very competitive at the top end of the game, unable to produce on the big occasion. The last 6 months, her results have not been up to scratch at all. And then suddenly she produces this run here. And also, it shows what a good final player she is. She's won her last 9 finals, which is a heck of a stat. And it, you know, something Matt's put down in our agenda here is the comparison to Wozniacki a year ago. That felt big at the time. It felt like a hurdle had been jumped there for Wozniacki, and then she did go on and she won the Australian Open. And I just wonder whether both Svitolina and maybe in a couple of weeks' time we might be talking about Zverev winning this tournament. This could be a big springboard for these players.
Hang on, Zverev lost to Marius Koppel.
I know, I'm just saying, but it feels like...
That is a different state of affairs to Elina Svitolina.
But don't you feel like if Zverev were to win the ATP finals, it might be the kind of...
It's a
the
big
bridge,
if.
The bridge between that and Grand Slam success.
Could be for anyone
I seem
that might win
saying
the
that
ATP
about
finals.
Grigor Dimitrov a year ago.
Yeah.
Okay, my theory doesn't work. So anyway, I would have asked Svitolina.
Let's talk about that in 2 weeks, should that come to pass.
Right.
Look, I think it could be. I think she's good enough to win a Grand Slam title. I don't want to hark on too much about the speed of the courts, but that, you know, the Australian Open will play extremely differently. And as I laboured the point on last week's podcast, I think the speed of the court was a very significant factor. You know, I wouldn't have picked Svitolina before the tournament, but having watched the first couple of days, I suddenly was starting to look at Stevens, more so Stevens, but yeah, the likes of Svitolina. So I think that's not insignificant, but hey, in punishing physical conditions in Australia, you know, if she gets there, she does find that exact right formula for her physicality, and she gets there and she's able to outlast players, absolutely she could win the Australian Open. I don't think there's anyone that would say she couldn't.
She's more vulnerable though to big hitters, isn't she?
Yeah,
at
exactly.
That tournament and those tournaments with slightly quicker surfaces.
Yeah, and she's always going to be, I think, you know, even when she does finesse the formula, she's never going to be a power player. She will always be susceptible to being hit through, but once upon a time, we might have said that about Simona Halep as well.
Yeah.
So,
not a different player. And actually, talking to Nigel Sears, who knows Andrew Bettles, the coach of Ilina Svitolina, very well. I remember him saying, just as we were approaching the final of Rome earlier this year, and it was Halep against Svitolina, the view from inside the camp of Svitolina seemed to be that if Svitolina was on, she felt she could actually overpower Halep. And actually, when you watch their matches, they're so similar. They can go toe-to-toe, and you do see that ability to have maybe a little bit more on the shots from Svitolina.
I think Halep finds it very difficult playing Svitolina because she likes feeding on other's pace, doesn't she? And Svitolina gives her nothing. I think it was in the Rome final this year when Halep got Darren Cahill down and she just expressed her frustration she said it was like, you know, playing someone in slow motion. She was just getting absolutely nothing, and that was really frustrating. So, yeah, I mean, maybe, but look, she can't model her game on being a ball striker.
No.
She knows that.
She needs to be the package, really.
Yeah. Hey, look, I'm not predicting. I don't think I will be putting her name in the champions column on our
predictions. It's funny that, though, isn't it? Why is that? Why do
but then
we
I
never
don't know who
up,
I will be putting there.
We never end up picking Svitolina.
Hey, hang on. It's the end of the... Who's going to win this? We can do... We know all we're going to know, other than sort of coaching changes and, I don't know, injuries.
Yeah, but
so
the
on.
Coaching changes matter, Catherine.
Okay, let's
the
say there aren't any.
The carousel matters. Naomi Osaka's already revealed that she will not be changing coaches. Sasha Bayin is here to stay.
Well, why would she?
I tell you, that's a good alliance. I like Sasha Bayin a lot.
Yeah, why would she? No Kamal Murray for Sloane Stephens in Singapore.
No.
She had a guy called Sylvester... Ooh.
Okay.
They were calling him Sly on BT Sport anyway.
Of course they were.
Which I found... I don't know, I know that is an official abbreviation of Sylvester, but it just felt rude.
Rocky's back. Anyway,
yeah.
Caroline Wozniacki, a little story that has come out of the WTA finals. She was involved, was it against Svitolina? I think it was, where she went one set all and that qualified Svitolina for the semi-finals, didn't it? It was quite a moment, that. After that match, it knocked Wozniacki out. We heard news that Wozniacki was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis after the US Open, which is a heck of a debilitating
before the US Open
illness, to be struck down with. She says, I couldn't lift my arms over my head. I mean, I know a couple of people who've suffered from rheumatoid arthritis, and that is a really tough thing to have for anybody to just function in day-to-day life, let alone an athlete.
Yeah, it must be... I can only imagine how difficult it is for an athlete to be diagnosed with a chronic illness, something that they know they can't be cured of, you know, that it's not, you know, they're so used to sort of seeing obstacles, seeing things to be overcome, tackling them, you know, figuring out a plan to tackle them and get past them. This is something she can only manage, you know, it's not something she can overcome, which must mentally for an athlete be incredibly difficult. However, my understanding is that it definitely can be managed. Obviously, there are going to be times when it does present difficulties for her. But she's only got to look at Venus Williams, hasn't she? You know, Sjögren's syndrome can present with quite similar symptoms during flare-ups to rheumatoid arthritis, joint pain, joint swelling. And again, obviously, there have been some bad results for Venus that I'm sure would be in part attributable to her illness. She never attributes it to that, does she? But she's 38 years old and still going and producing brilliant results, and she's an absolute... I mean, you couldn't wish for a better role model in that regard.
Yeah.
So I wish her well. I'm, you know, she's going to have the best medical team possible, isn't she? But I mean, at the moment of diagnosis, that must have been just hearing the words you've got I mean, that doesn't sound great, does it?
No, and that's something she'll have to deal with for life too. So a tough diagnosis, but we wish Caroline Wozniacki all the best with that. Doubles champions Tamea Babos and Kristina Mladenovic over Katerina Siniaková and Barbora Krejčíková of the Czech Republic. So well,
comparisons
then.
Between Mladenovic and Sok?
Yes, I think that's fair. A similar singles drop-off, but absolutely formidable doubles player. I also think it does show that sometimes I think it shows what a lonely place the singles court is, and how some people maybe just, it's just better for them socially and personally to be on a doubles court. Maybe as just in order to sustain the life of tennis professional. I could believe that.
Yeah, I guess she certainly seems like she's always seemed absolutely lovely to me, Kiki Mladenovic, and there's no doubt she and Tamea Babos have a great friendship. That's not a sort of a mercenary working partnership, is it? They're absolutely a team in every sense. They're very active on social media together. Yeah, I can believe that. And I think the same was the case with Caroline Garcia before it all went hideously wrong. But she's too good not to do it in singles.
Well, it'd be
well.
A waste, wouldn't it, for her not to rediscover some of the form she got last year when she got to the top 10, and really plays a type of tennis that is exciting and uplifting and different. So you want to see her put that on the court as often as she can. As we said, Singapore's final year of hosting it. I've been to the event a couple of times, very much enjoyed it. Sometimes a little frustrated by the crowds that were there, but this year actually looked like the crowds were bigger, certainly from what I could see.
I think last year was the low point in terms of crowds, wasn't it? It felt like the as a venue city, it had run out of a bit of steam. But so I suspect the fact that they knew they were losing it this year, you know, Singaporeans' last chance to sample the event, injected a bit of impetus into the ticket sales, I suspect.
As did Osaka, I think, although her results were... She didn't get the results she wanted, and she didn't win a match, but she clearly did bring with her some backing of her own, and just another great step for her. But yeah, Shenzhen for the next 10 years. Ooh, my goodness, that is a big old stay.
Such a long deal, isn't it? And what if it's just a terrible failure?
Well,
and they know they're locked into it for 10 years.
That is a tough one.
Well,
they were locked into a deal
with
beIN Sports, and that's ended. They were Tennis Channel as a broadcasting deal.
That's true. Apparently it ended with the coverage being abruptly cut off before the trophy ceremony. They didn't show Svitolina speaking.
Nice.
They abruptly cut it off to head to an hour's build-up of Premier League football.
No, it was the Clásico in La Liga.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, which is quite a big deal. But, I mean, it also shows the problem with only having one channel.
You can sacrifice 5 minutes
sport.
Of build-up for...
Yeah, but you need multiple channels, don't you? You need more spaces for it to go. Look, at least with Tennis Channel now in the States, that's a good home. That's where it should be, really, in terms of at least...
in the name.
You know, yeah. I mean, that's not the only only channel. I mean, ESPN do a very good job with tennis, I think, generally as well. But you need to be able to have it on a platform that gives it its due and attention. Basel, Roger Federer, 99th career title, and he's been winning titles there. I think this is his eighth one now in Basel.
Ninth, it's his ninth.
Is it?
Yeah.
Crikey. That's a heck of a
Don't
idea,
do
man.
The guy down,
oh, yeah.
David.
Ninth title. Blimey. And he's been going there. I actually realised that I was there the first year he reached the final in 2000. I was courtside. Don't eye roll at me as though I'm 84. I was courtside when he faced Thomas Enquist. And this was after a semi-final in which, for the first time in his career, he beat Leighton Hewitt. And completely turned around the rivalry. Well, at least started to turn around
the rivalry for a little while, didn't they?
Leighton Hewitt was totally dominating that rivalry.
And then Federer started completely dominating the rivalry. And then there was that Davis Cup match where Hewitt came from two sets to love down.
Yeah, that's right.
2002,
after that, Federer barely lost a match to him. But what I remember about that was, afterwards, when Federer came off the court, the rivalry score in total is 18-9 between Federer and Hewitt. And yes, that was the fourth meeting between the two. Federer had lost the first three, and he won 6-4, 5-7, 7-6, 8-6 in the tiebreak after that. And actually, he still ended up losing, did Federer, four of the next five. between the two. So, you know, it was an absolutely dominant rivalry for Hewitt. What's that? 7-2 he was ahead. And then he only won one more in the next 17.
Anything else from the David Law memory banks?
No, not
Basel
really.
Basel related.
Well, anyway, what I wanted to say is Federer came off the court that day and he said, he pointed to the inner parts of his thighs and he said, when you play Hewitt, your legs are just screaming, you know, just in the pain of being jerked from side to side on the court by the way Hewitt plays against you. And you could tell that this is just... I mean, he would have only been about 19 years of age at that time, and it shows how you have to develop as an athlete as well as a tennis player. Anyway, carry on, Catherine. What happened yesterday?
Well, as we've established, Roger Federer won, beating Marius Koppel in the final. Straight sets in the end, although he was 40 down in the second set, really had to turn that around. Koppel, incidentally, as I mentioned, that beat Sasha Zverev in the semi-finals. I didn't see the match, but I did seek an assessment from special Federer reporter Matthew Whitaker. So his assessment of Federer's final performance reads thus: not vintage, and no questions really asked of him, not much info gained. Backhand looking better though, front foot lighter on the ground. He's still doing that thing of bricking one service game per set. Fine against someone who gives you chances. Against Djokovic, that's just a 6-4, 6-3 loss. Which I think is a very crucial point there.
It's quite hard to know where to put this week, isn't it, for Federer? Because, look, let's not be churlish. He's won the title. It's his 99th title overall, right? You can't win a title and be completely written off. It's not fair, is it? But then he's beaten Koppel in the final. He's beaten Krajinovic, Struff, Simon, Medvedev. He's struggled against some of those players. And he's lost his serve loads of times. 13 times he lost his serve in Basel. I mean, that's not what happens to Roger
Federer,
and
given the fact
it?
That, you know, ahead of the week, you'd say anything other than lifting the title at the end of this week is a failure for Roger Federer,
particularly
let's be
honest. If you'd have played those guys, or if you'd have played some of the others that were there,
I think it's okay to judge Roger Federer by a pretty high standard, and probably he'd never say it. You know, all we see is the jubilant pictures of him dishing out pizza to ball kids, which is a lovely tradition, by the way, that they do in Basel.
Pizza?
I thought it was
a medal or something.
Oh, they do pizza for all the ball kids. The winner takes a load of pizzas to the ball kids.
I
think deep down, you know, in 6 months' time, he might be telling us that, you know, he had some kind of crippling finger injury this week. I think if he were to take a lie detector, he'd probably say that he is a bit concerned. On the basis of what I've heard there from Math, I certainly wouldn't... frankly, Djokovic is just head and shoulders above everyone, including Roger Federer at the moment. Those are the facts, I think. It doesn't sound like there's anything to indicate that he would give Djokovic more of a challenge.
Mm. No, It's hard to be honest to look at the field that is lining up for the ATP Finals right now and identify someone you could say I fancy him against Djokovic. Djokovic is going to be the favourite against
unless
all of
he gets
them.
Injured or has an awful day.
You would say Nadal, but Nadal's been injured for a long time now, and he's making his comeback in Paris.
He's certainly talking up a good game about his intention and desire to play both Paris and London. He's not saying too much about the body or where he feels he's at, but he certainly wants to play.
How about Marius Koppel? 151 mile an hour serve in the final he hit, and he beat Cilic and Zverev en route. I think the first time I properly watched a full match of his. A bit like watching Ons Jabeur last week. It's just, you suddenly look at this guy, you've seen his name loads, you maybe caught a few points here and there, but then you watch a match and you think, crikey, he's a big bloke who hits it hard. When he played Murray in that 3-hour epic.
Best known for losing to Murray at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah,
and
Murray crying.
Cracks the ball quite hard. I mean, I don't think this is the start of Marius Koppel's charge towards the top 20.
No, but it's nice to see somebody who's just standing up and taken these guys on. And that's actually a disappointing loss for Zverev, really, on the route.
Yeah, for ATP finals is going to be interesting for Zverev, do you think?
It is.
Despite the fact that you've just predicted him to win it and win the Australian Open.
I didn't do that. I was doing a what if. I think the next 12 months for Zverev, this time next year, let's bookmark this conversation. Where is Zverev going to be? At Tennis Podcast, let us know.
What's your answer?
What will that 12 months for Zverev look like? I think he will have reached the final of a Grand Slam.
And still be with Ivan Lendl.
Yes. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I have a few more doubts than I had 6 months ago and 12 months ago. But I think on balance, probably yes.
Okay, let's
bookmark
that.
But if he hasn't, then I won't keep predicting that every year. If he doesn't do it this year, then...
Give us your Zverev predictions for October the 29th, 2019. What will Alexander Zverev's career look like at that point?
We've excelled ourselves with predictions with no basis.
Prediction
there.
Bonanza here on the Tennis Podcast.
Dear.
Vienna. Kevin Anderson, who is just Mr. Reliable, has won his first ATP 500 title. He beat Kei Nishikori 6-3-7-6.
Do you think he's all right with being called Mr. Reliable?
Yeah, I think he'd
Wouldn't
love
he rather
it.
Be like Mr. I've just won the biggest title of my career?
Well, he's reliably performing and producing every single week. I think he'd probably take less to what I called him the other week, as certainly his wife complained. When
Remind me what you called him.
I just said he may not be Mr. Charisma. However, what I was trying to say is...
You didn't say he's not Mr. Charisma. You said he may not be Mr. Charisma.
The point I was trying to make is, look, he's not a song and dance man. Maybe he's not getting all this attention. He's not getting loads of attention for doing nothing, right?
You don't know next he's not to a song nothing. And dance man.
Okay,
he might have a secret side to him.
My guess is he's not, and he certainly
he's too big to be a song and dance.
He
man.
Certainly doesn't make a thing of being one. But the point I was trying to make was that this is somebody who, in spite of the fact that he doesn't get attention for his potential or reputation or his I don't know, personality, nobody talks about him for those particular points, he keeps shoehorning himself into the conversation.
he will not go away, he keeps
on making sure that you have to consider him because of his results and the way he applies himself, and he is outperforming what I certainly would have expected to be his potential, and I think he's an absolutely creditable
man. You stop talking about players' potential in their 30s, don't you? He's 32,
yeah.
And he's going to make his debut at the ATP Finals. That's amazing.
Do you know, the other thing is, he's starting to become relevant, not only for his results, but for what just a decent person he is showing himself to be, because he's not just a decent person quietly with his mates behind the scenes. He's standing up.
Yeah.
He's on the player council.
And that's disgust.
He's prepared to put his head above the parapet and actually stand for something.
Yeah.
And look,
playing any exhibition in Saudi Arabia.
I have the greatest respect for the boat. Yeah, the Saudi Arabian exhibition, as stands, is not cancelled. It is expected to go ahead as things stand. Both Nadal and Djokovic have been asked about it. Both of them have made the point in Paris that they made a commitment to take part in that exhibition a year ago. And they are...
Back when Saudi Arabia was a stand-up place with a great human rights record.
Well, certainly before this particular incident with the journalist took place, and they, at this stage, have said that they don't intend to make any decision at the moment, but they know that something very bad happened, and they are looking to see how that situation evolves.
They're playing for time, aren't they?
And is clarified.
Yeah, look, I mean...
They're reading the temperature, I think, of the situation
but,
before
I mean,
making
what's,
a final call.
Like, you know, what information are they waiting for? I mean, I find the statements baffling, if not maybe particularly surprising. I find Djokovic is particularly disappointing because he says he doesn't like to involve himself in any political exchange or situations, which, you know, is just patently untrue, isn't it? I mean, he's done a lot of good work and stood up for a lot of things, particularly at home in Serbia, where where he's not been afraid to stick his neck out. And a lot of people have speculated that he might one day want a future in politics. And also, as established when we first talked about it, this is a state-sponsored event as part of a political state-sponsored program of propaganda. Sporting propaganda is very deliberate. It's called the Sporting Propaganda Program, I think, to try and attract major sporting events and superstar sportsmen to give legitimacy to the state of Saudi Arabia. So you cannot extricate yourself from the political dynamics of this situation.
The bottom line is, if you are playing the match, or if you are signed up to play the match, you are inevitably involved in that conversation, aren't you?
Whether they want to be or not, and I'm sure they'd rather not be in this situation. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure, well, I hope that they both wish they'd never signed up to it in the first place.
I'm sure they do.
But the fact is, they are being used as instruments of the Saudi Arabian state. They are. And they need to face up to that when making their decision.
Hmm. Okay, well, we'll follow it.
But let's see.
Hopefully, they're
just buying time.
Yeah. I dare say. Yeah. I would imagine they are. Nishikori has now, incidentally, he lost to Kevin Anderson in the final in Vienna. Lost his last nine finals.
Yeah, it's not good, that, is it?
So it's weird, isn't it, how Nishikori's lost his last nine finals and yet he's got one of the best five-set records around.
I can't explain that data. I've got no pithy summary to explain that.
Whereas I've lost my last three chokes, and you know, from being ahead, and I've never won a long match either. So
it's because of your high intelligence level, David. Thanks. I keep telling you.
You've got that one up your sleeve every time I need it. Perfect. Tennis podcast people, stick together. That's what I'm telling you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
GB doubles have had a great week because there are seven great British males in the top 70 of the ATP doubles rankings. Jamie Murray, Dominic Inglot, who got the title with his old mate Franco stroke Victor Skugor in Basel against the Zverev brothers. Joe Salisbury, who suddenly just jumped onto the scene over the last year. I mean, if somebody a year ago had mentioned the name Joe Salisbury to you, I don't think I would have known who that is.
Sounds like a stage name, doesn't it?
He's top 30 in the world now in doubles. That is a fantastic ride.
Well, what about Luke Bambridge and Johnny O'Mara?
Well, they got a title last week. I forgot to mention that, by the way. I meant to and forgot to do so.
Did you know about them a year ago?
Yeah, I did. Oh, I'd heard of them, but I'd literally never heard the name Charles Salisbury until about 6 months ago. And he and Neil Skupski joined forces to win the Vienna doubles title. So congratulations to them. And Ken Skupski as well is in the top 70 of the men's doubles too. So, yeah, British doubles flying.
Where are all our women's doubles players?
Well, I think there's a few of those, isn't there?
Yeah, but nothing like the men.
I spent some time with Joss Ray commentating.
I liked her commentary. So
BT
she was
Sport
really
the
good.
Other week. She was very
great
good.
Great combo,
yeah.
Law
oh, well,
Ray.
All right.
See,
Ray
Law.
Getting bigged up because she realises how hard I've taken my choke, that she's been nice this week. Yeah, Joss Ray was very interesting. She got to 60-something in the world in doubles and then eventually called it a day. She and I were talking a little bit about life on tour and the challenges of, you know, just trying to be on the tour and constantly travelling and the toll that takes on you. And it's not just about playing tennis matches, you know. I really do sort of empathise with that, and it's not for everybody. And she had a good career, but it's to keep on going around this tour, especially if things aren't going that well, must be really tough. Stefanos Tsitsipas is somebody who we've talked a lot about in glowing terms over the course of the year, both his results, his behaviour off court, what a likeable, engaging chap he seems to be. He's not had his best public relations week, has he?
Oh, I'm not sure about that. He's
initially.
Yeah, but actually, I mean, well, he's had a good crisis communication week.
He's rescued
it. Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you what happened. He was on court. A clip emerged over the last couple of days of him on court, and this follows the situation with Fernando Verdasco shouting at ball kids and then Arina Sabalenka dropping a bottle in front of her and waiting for a ball kid to pick it up. In this situation, Tsitsipas is shown doing one of those things where you've been given your new restrung racket with its cellophane on, you're holding the handle of it and waiting for the ball kid to pull off the cellophane. And he sort of offers his racket out towards the ball girl, who grabs hold of the cellophane. Tsitsipas turns his back, walks off, and in frustration just yanks at his racket and pulls it out of the wrapper, which was a slightly shocking thing to witness, really. My take on it was, yeah, it looks poor. He shouldn't have done it. I think he really didn't realise what he'd done until he probably saw it back, because he turned his back on her as he did it. When he saw that video footage, he immediately replies to the clip to just make the point that, you know, I really didn't, that wasn't acceptable what I did, and I apologise for my mistake. He says, I was a ball kid once, and trust me, the job they have to put to have things in order is twice more than us players on court. I do appreciate everything they have to go through to make us feel comfortable and satisfied when we do our job. They're a big help.
Yeah, there was another tweet as well, wasn't it, where he did explicitly apologise.
Yes, he did. Yeah. He did. And I just thought, you know, a lot of people were jumping on and giving him a hard time. And I think rightfully so, it should be pointed out the same way as it was with everybody else. But I like the fact that, and it read to me as though he'd seen that and reacted to it rather than being told what to do by somebody who's an advisor.
Yeah, it read to me like that as well. I mean, the only distinction I'd make between this incident and the Verdasco one or the Sabalenka one is it was entitled rather than vicious seeming. It was the entitlement of him just turning his back and assuming someone will take care of this perfunctory task for me. Rather, he wasn't directing anything at a ball kid, which is a minor distinction maybe, but one worth making. But yeah, great response. Great response.
Actually,
he saw everyone, you know, like with Serena, you know, everyone has bad moments. You know,
can imagine
that doesn't excuse
that,
every type of behaviour by just saying, oh, I had a bad moment. But, you know, a lot can be rescued with a response. And he's very much done that.
Yeah, he has. And I would imagine that he will be the sort of chap who doesn't do that again. Personally.
Yeah, he's a learner, isn't he?
Next-gen finals about to take place. Tsitsipas alongside Denis Shapovalov.
News of plans for the draw ceremony, David, yet to be announced. What do you think they'll do?
Something very quiet and sensible. Alex de Minaur, Francis
Tiafoe. Something quiet and sensible. It is being held in Italy, you know.
Andre Rublev, Taylor Fritz, and is it Ivo Munar? I can't remember what his first name is.
Jaume.
Is it? Okay, right.
Jaume. I think it's actually pronounced Jaume.
Okay, and an Italian wild card will make up the field. That is actually a lineup I'm quite looking forward to seeing some of those matches, I must say.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, Rublev's had an injury-struck year. Taylor Fritz, he's just not kicked on, has he?
He's had some results this year. And he's under the guidance of Paul Anacone. I can't remember what it was now, but about three weeks ago, I remember him fighting back from a really difficult position and winning one of the close matches. I think he's done all right, actually, Taylor Fritz, this year. But it's still relative, speaking. I mean, if you go back three years...
He's done all right in next-gen terms. Yeah. He's not... that's what I mean. He's not kicked on in the way that people were expecting.
No. Well,
he was the leader of the American youngsters.
49 in the world now he is, whereas TFO is 44 in the world.
And you'd say, if you just looked at their games and potential-wise, as people were doing a couple of years ago, Fritz was being picked as the one with greater potential.
Dimonor is 33 in the world, Shapovalov's 29, and Tsitsipas really does separate himself, being 16 in the world. So fascinating, really, to see how these people develop, the rate at which they do so. Quite looking forward to that. And actually, new video technology addition to the Next Gen and Finals is that the line call technology, the sort of Hawkeye type stuff, is going to be used to judge knot-ups, you know, double bounces of a tennis ball, foul shots if you reach over the net and play a volley, or if you touch the net before you play a volley. These are all going to be used with technology.
Yeah, I'm all up for that.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems very obvious.
I understand
it's all going to happen via some sort of watch. Some sort of smartwatch that the umpires will be wearing.
I quite like the way they use the Next Gen Finals to try out all these things.
Me too.
It's quite a sensible way of
Me
doing
too.
It. So the ATP Finals field is being decided as well. At
defending
the same time.
Champion ain't in it.
No, he ain't. Grigor Dimitrov, who has been seen in Paris with Andre Agassi.
Andre
Agassi coaching on a consultancy basis, or at least a tryout basis. He's been brought in by Danny Valverde to have a look at Grigor Dimitrov. Andre Agassi, what do you think?
I mean, I'm obviously fascinated by it. For us lot, it's the dream, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a brilliant thing to talk about. It didn't go well with Djokovic.
But the
reasons given for that by Agassi were that Djokovic didn't really want to hear what he had to say at the time. And by all accounts, looking back, Djokovic might not have been in the right headspace at that time to take on board new messaging. I think Dimitrov is going to listen. I think he's a good student, isn't he? He might not be able, for other reasons, to put it into practice, but I think he'll be very up for and respectful and all of that about hearing what Agassi has to say.
And he's somebody who needs, every so often, a bit of a reboot and a bit of a new injection of ideas, I think.
Yeah, and I like that it's Valverde that's brought him in, because, I still think, as awful as Grigor's results have been, I still don't think that's necessarily to do with Danny Valverde. Like, I don't think just getting rid of him and bringing in the next coach on the carousel is the right thing to do for Grigor Dimitrov. But maybe bringing in a new voice is. Whether Agassi is the right voice, I have no idea. There's certainly a lot of mental unpicking to do.
I like it. I like it as a concept, at the very least. I think, you know, it's a bit of a, why not? Why not throw the dice?
Exactly, why not?
Like,
I mean,
it's
throwing the dice big, though, isn't it?
And Agassi as well, for him, too. He's got just a little bit of reputation rebuilding to do here. Because, frankly, it didn't go well with Djokovic. It was a bit embarrassing, really, the way he ended things and said, look, we had to agree to disagree too often. And then the next thing you know, Djokovic goes back to Marijan Vida, the man who he'd worked with for so long, and has suddenly got all of these results. Now, some of that success may be in part due to some of the things that Agassi was teaching him over the course of the time, but it doesn't look great, does it, on the CV for Agassi as coach. It will be interesting to see. And Dimitrov is the perfect type of case study to prove you can make a difference, isn't he? Because we know he's got a very expansive game that can be successful, but he has got a lot going on mentally that has held him back.
It's not going to be the case of just, I'm not saying there wasn't hard work for Ivan Lendl to do with Andy Murray, say to take him from from nearly to Grand Slam champion, but it did feel like, you know, it's there. You've just got to tap into it. You might have to build something with Dimitrov that we don't yet know is there. It might never be there. It might not be buildable, but it's not a question of just rooting around and flicking, finding the switch and flicking it. I mean, as you say, it's not a nothing to lose situation for Agassi because of how his coaching CV currently looks. So, I mean, yeah, it's a trial basis at the moment, but he wouldn't be accepting that job or even the trial if he didn't think he could.
There's got to be an upside.
If he could do what needs doing. The question is, what will be the benchmark of success? Does it have to be winning a Grand Slam? Or have we lowered our expectations?
Well, I think, you've got to get Dimitrov back to where he was a year ago in terms of feeling like... I mean, this year he's won 23 matches and lost 18. That is appalling for a guy of Grigor Dimitrov's standards.
It's rubbish.
And he needs to be a relevant force again. He needs to have his identity back as a player who doesn't choke, frankly. And on the subject of choking...
Oh, I see what you did there.
I didn't intend to, but it worked out. On the subject of choking, we are going to get this in. At Tennis Podcast, we've been asking you to tell us about some of the most excruciating chokes, minor side, that you've remembered. A lot of this came off the back of some of the results Marin Cilic has had, and we talk about Dimitrov. Now, Cilic has had a good year in some ways. He reached an Australian Open final. He won Queens. But he's had some pretty alarming losses from victorious-looking positions. At the US Open, he led Kei Nishikori by a set and a break, and he lost in five. Davis Cup semi-final, he had set points in the second set tiebreak against Querrey to go two sets to love up, and he lost in four. In Tokyo, he served for the match twice against Jean-Lennard Struff and lost in three. And Nicholas Jarry lost to in Shanghai. I mean, these are pretty severe defeats for a guy of his level of experience and quality, and do suggest something amiss mentally in these situations. Now, even in my pathetic park level, I can relate to the nerves that you go through when you're closing in on a victorious, glorious win, and then only for it all to go horribly wrong. But some of these that people have sent in, at best off forehand, remembers Anna Ivanovic losing for 5-1 up.
He's got the best off forehand in the world.
He does have a good one. Roger,
is that
hello,
Roger Federer,
our listener. Anna Ivanovic losing 5-1, 40 love up in the deciding set against Kim Clijsters in Miami 2011.
Ouch.
Jake Davis remembers Guillermo Coria against Gaston Gaudia.
Yeah, that's six had a few love, shouts.
6-love, 6-3 for Coria, then capitulated and said he felt powerless afterwards, couldn't control his nervousness. There's, of course, at Truth and Tennis, who remembers Todd Martin leading 5-1 in the fifth set against Mal Washington in the 96 Wimbledon semi-final, failed to serve it out twice and lost it 10-8 in the Wimbledon semi-finals. Gabriella Sabatini, a few people have mentioned, leading Steffi Graf in the Wimbledon final of 91, twice served for the title. And then the dear, much-missed Jana Novotna's Wimbledon final defeat to Steffi Graf. We all remember her crying on the shoulder of
which prompted the crying
Duchess
on the shoulder. Yeah.
But actually, the one that I remember more in her specific situation was one that's been sent into us as well. I remember watching this match against Chanda Rubin in 1995 at the French Open, and Novotna was 5-love up, 40-love up in the final set, and eventually had 9 match points before losing at 8-6 in the third. I mean, and she had some obviously incredibly victorious moments as well, winning Wimbledon against Natalie Tauziah in the final. But it is one of those
Tauziah
things, isn't it? Yeah.
Tauziah.
Yeah, Tauziah. What did I say?
Tauziah.
All right, well.
Never heard that before.
You
in
say
my
tomato.
Life.
Anyway, what is it about closing out a match? That, and actually, some people have said that is what separates the greats. That they don't choke very often. Yeah, they do sometimes, don't they? I'm trying to remember. Have you seen Novak Djokovic choke? I think the closest I've seen is a couple of those Wimbledon finals.
During that 18-month period where he was off, can't think of a specific example, but there were definitely moments where I could see... could see the mental frailty in a way that I never had before. I don't see it anymore.
Nadal?
I mean, I remember, well, in your Strokes of Genius, not your documentary.
My
I mean,
Strokes of Genius.
In the brilliant documentary about Federer and Nadal, Strokes of Genius,
that
in
I was
which
in.
David Law featured, he talks about that, how he was very close to choking.
That's the first time I've seen Nadal final. Choke,
yeah.
Actually. You're quite right. Yeah.
I mean, he did end up going on to win it.
How? I will never
but
know.
But, yeah, he choked in moments. I mean, Andy Murray talks about in the Wimbledon final, the first one that he won, 2013, even though he was two sets to love, what, five, serving 5-4?
Yeah.
He says that he felt like, if I didn't win that game, like...
I'm not sure
I'm going to win the match. I have to win this game.
Yeah.
Despite being two sets and a break up. Which, you know, tells you everything you need to know about... I mean, yeah, I refer you again to the Freakonomics podcast about analysing the pathology and the psychology of choking.
I'm going to have to listen to that before our rematch. Do you know, it is nearly 4 years now since we played that match. And if I get to the brink of victory against you, I don't know what I'm going to do.
By the Kevin Anderson metric, I have reached my physical peak. Since then, the age of 32.
Have you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, who knows? There could yet be more peaks for Kevin Anderson.
Where am I?
I hope 33 proves to be another peak.
Where am I in my curve?
I don't know. Best not to ask.
I haven't had a peak, and I am not going to have one.
Who's
going to
win Paris?
I'm going to be peakless. I don't know. That's a very good question.
You don't think Novak Djokovic is going to win Paris?
Well, I think of all the tournaments that he's going to win, that would be one of the least likely, personally, just because I don't think he needs it as much as some of the others.
But I think he can win it without needing
it
too much.
He needs it now that Nadal's entered, and he desperately wants to finish world number one, doesn't he?
Do you think the person in the field that wants it the most... is Federer because of the 100 titles thing?
No, not necessarily. I think there's a few people who want it big time.
Who else? Who wants it more than Federer?
Yeah, I mean, you might be right. Actually, I don't. The thing is, I don't even know if Federer is going to end up playing.
Well,
it.
Yeah, that's
as we
that
sit
is
here,
still a question mark.
Monday morning, he is entered, but you know he's due to play his first match on Wednesday. He actually said he'll make his final mind up tomorrow, so we'll find out. But yeah, that 100th title, when it comes, that will be a pretty big moment. That's a big number.
That's
but
huge,
yeah. I tell you what, just as a quick final note, something that I've really enjoyed on Twitter the last couple of days is some of the replies from Pam Shriver to a few people. She's quite spiky, and she even colleagues of hers and so forth. I can't remember who it was who said... when Andre Agassi, it was Marty Fish, Andre Agassi was appointed by Dimitrov, and Marty Fish said, "What a tennis mind, an incredible hire." And Pam Shriver said, "Well, come back to me in Australia and let's see actually if he's made any difference before you say that." And then she also said about the 100, somebody else said, "What an incredible achievement, 100 titles for Roger Federer. Go and look at the results that Martin and Navratilova accumulated." Before you just get too excited about 100 titles. Quite like Pam Shriver, don't you?
Yeah, speaking of spiky people on Twitter, don't ever tell David Law that Pete Sampras is boring.
Yeah, I did rise to that one a bit. Yeah. Well, look, it's all in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? Boring, interesting, it's whatever you float your boat. But I do think people's memories are very short and selective. I think some people, yeah, absolutely right. There are a lot of people that did not enjoy the era of Pete Sampras and his dominance. And yes, his style of play with those really fast conditions could end up being just a serving contest. And that was a tough watch. And I didn't enjoy that particularly either. But I also remember all the other bits when he played on clay against some of the players. And when he took on Andre Agassi and beat him from the baseline more often than not. I thought those were wonderful years. And yeah, there were some special moments where he was in that just excruciating match where he cried against Jim Courier when his coach was dying and still beat Courier while he was in tears and he won
Twitter
his seventh Wimbledon.
Twitter doesn't allow for this sort of nuance though.
No.
You have to give an overall impression of not everybody exclusively felt that Pete Sampras was boring, but I think the majority of people, if they were asked to, in crude terms, sum up how they felt about the Pete Sampras domination of tennis, they probably would say boring. That doesn't mean it's wrong to have not found him boring.
It's just such a catch-all, lazy label to give to somebody's entire career, though, isn't it? It's just...
No, but I think you're conflating appreciation of achievement with enjoyment of the spectacle.
But I think people also just decide what their view is, and they don't actually consider any of the detail anymore because they've made up their mind.
Yeah, maybe. And to be fair, he's not, because he's so disappeared from the scene, he's not there reminding us.
Oh, absolutely.
About, you know, I wish he was more present to remind us of...
Always remember somebody saying to me once that people tend to forget that Mats Wilander won the same number of Grand Slam titles as John McEnroe.
But that's because Mats Wilander's not reminding us.
No, exactly.
John McEnroe is.
Well, that's why I'm doing the reminding for you, you know.
Seven-time Grand Slam champion, Mats Wilander. I always introduce him as that.
And former world number one, just the same as John.
Yeah.
Hmm. This has been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with our executive producers, Melody Bowes, TennisBalls.com and Triple S. We are sponsored by La Manga Club. Mascot is Charlie the Ferret, who's just posted on Twitter a little reminder of the year he's had as our mascot, rooting around in the little... outfit box that we sent him and all of his various merchandise, of which you can get, incidentally, not ferret merchandise for yourselves,
but you can get
Tennis Podcast t-shirts and hoodies and goodness knows what on our website, tennispodcast.net.
For those asking about dog attire, I'm working on it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, fine. Catherine is in charge of dog attire. And Catherine will be back alongside myself, David Law, here on the Tennis Podcast in a week from now. And we'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.